Sex dolls in particular, the main reason people don't like them is they don't realize how much work it is to clean them after using them and dressing them, and then the material can become tacky if you don't coat it properly with stuff. So it's a lot of upkeep, it's a lot of work. People love their things and they become very attached to them when that thing is able to return some semblance of emotional connection, romantic connection, sexual connection. It's only going to further enhance those feelings. You are a young guy. You still have your whole life ahead of you. Being married can be a very fulfilling thing. Having kids can be a wonderful life experience. You are too young to throw in the towel, and you should not buy a doll. Go out with your friends, have a couple drinks, listen to some sad music, do whatever you need to do to grieve and move on with your life. And if in 10, 20, 30 years you come back and you say, I still want a doll, we'll still be here.
You think only lonely single men buy sex dolls? Actually, 30% of users are married. But why are committed men spending thousands of dollars on these? I'm Dr. Rena Malik, urologist and pelvic surgeon, and today we're talking about who's really using sex technology, what their partners think, and what this means for relationships. Welcome back to the Rena Malik MD podcast, your trusted guide for leveling up your health, sex life, and relationships with evidence-based tools. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Ken Hansen, a sociologist who spent years studying the real people behind these technologies, and his findings are going to shock you. We're exploring a world where married men use sex dolls with their partner's knowledge, where people form genuine emotional bonds with AI chatbots, and where a $3,000 purchase might actually stem from past relationship trauma and not loneliness. But here's what is really interesting: how this technology might be quietly reshaping human sexuality in ways we're only just starting to understand. This conversation challenges every stereotype and might actually change how you think about intimacy and relationships. You don't want to miss this. Really quickly, before we get into the conversation, I have to let you guys know about my Better Sex, Better Life guide with my top 10 tips for more pleasure. www.renamalik.com/more pleasure. All right. Dr. Hansen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to learn from you today. And you have done some research on both sort of the sex tech world, like sex dolls and virtual AI companions, things of that nature. So what sort of first drew you into that particular topic, you know, in terms of all the things in sociology that you could study?
At this point, probably 6 or 7 years ago when I first started getting interested in sex tech, and it was actually a pretty simple observation. I was reading a news story. One of the dolls that they were talking about had a price tag of about $8,000, I think. And I was really floored with that, and just wanted to know who is spending thousands of dollars on a sex toy. I can't imagine doing that. I can't afford that personally. And so I started doing what any scientist does, right? I started reading the studies that were available and found that the vast majority of them were coming from philosophy, ethics, humanities type stuff. So there wasn't a lot of data. There wasn't a lot of looking at who are the people that are doing this, why are they doing it, what are their motivations. And so that became my research agenda, is trying to figure out who these users are, what are their life stories, why are they doing this, and what are they getting from it.
I mean, that's really fascinating. You said, you know, it's a sex toy, but I think a sex doll is sort of straddles this line of like a sex toy and something more. So maybe describe what exactly is a sex doll.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because some people do view them more like toys. Some people think about them as partners. But sex dolls, which are the more common product, I know a lot of people like to talk about sex robots, but realistically, the majority of people are just using dolls. They are full size, more or less approximations of human bodies. They range in price pretty considerably. There are some inflatable varieties that are maybe $100 or so, but most people think of the silicone and TPE models that are like I said, usually at least a couple $1,000s. I did one study that found the average was about $2,600. They have articulated joints, so you can bend their elbows, move their feet, things like that. They usually don't stand on their own. They have to be propped up or put on a stand. And then they have genitals that you can interact with, right? So some of those models are fixed, meaning that you can't change the genital configuration. Others do allow for you to put a penis attachment onto it. They also usually have an anal and a oral orifice for sexual intercourse. They're pretty close to human size in terms of height. The female sex dolls usually have very large breasts. My research shows that probably 50% or more are size E or bigger.
Yeah, that's a lot larger proportion than what we see in real life.
Yeah, much bigger. And penises also tend to be larger. So on the male sex dolls, we found the average is about 7 1/3 inches and about 5.5 to 6 inches circumference.
So that's significantly bigger than average. That's probably on the like top 5%, I would guess, in terms of length and girth.
Yeah, much bigger. And I've never seen a male sex doll that didn't have a six pack, right? So they're obviously hypersexualized and conforming to a particular idea about, you know, what a man is or what a woman is.
So you mentioned sex dolls are different from sex robots. So I think what exactly, you know, what's the transition between a doll and something that you're sort of controlling and a sex robot? And like, how are those, are we seeing more of those and who's kind of using those?
There's a couple of things that we might look for in a sex robot. One could be a mechanized way of moving. So it might be able to walk. It might be able to move its own joints on its own accord. Those are not available at this point in time. The only mechanized stuff that we're seeing is facial movement. So there's a couple of sex robots that are able to blink and move their mouth. There's also a couple that have maybe like vibrating capacities or heating capacities, and that starts to blur the line between a doll and a robot. The more common innovation we're seeing is the integration of AI systems into the doll. So thinking about it similar to a Siri or Alexa that has a call and response feature. You say something to it, it responds. Some of that matches up with its ability to blink and talk to you. There's not a lot of those available. Real Doll is the leading manufacturer of these products. They've made all of the innovations available. And I would say that the users of these are people that have a lot of disposable income because they're even more expensive than your standard doll. Overwhelmingly, men are using these because most of the robots are also female. And not that a lot of people use sex dolls, but an even smaller number use sex robots, right? This is a very, very small percent of the population.
So what is the cost for a sex robot? I'm not sure if that was the $8,000 you mentioned earlier or if it's even more expensive than that.
That would be getting into the $8,000 and up range. Real Doll prides itself on having a lot of customization options. So you can choose things like pubic hair pattern, eye color. You can have freckles, you can put tattoos on the doll, you can choose the hair color. And of course, with each thing that you want to change from the base model, that's an upgrade that's going to increase the price. And so you could definitely customize one well above $10,000 if you wanted to.
And then who's using sex dolls? I know you've done some work on this, looking at really like what kind of people are using them and what they're sort of looking for, what the motivations are really to use a sex doll.
Yeah, that was the thing that I was the most interested in, was figuring out who these people are, because I think there's a lot of stereotypes, right, and misconceptions that maybe these are lonely, sad, violent men or misogynistic men. And while that is present in the population, it's really not the average doll owner or doll user. So in the research that I did, I found that probably about 25 to 30% of doll users are either married or in a committed relationship with somebody else. So they might be using this in the bedroom with another person, or they in some cases are in a relationship where they're not having sex anymore because of age-related sex difficulties or something. And so the sex doll becomes a way for them to have a sexual interaction, but not feel like they're cheating on their partner. 37-ish% of people are what I would consider single on a permanent basis. They say, you know, I have this doll and this is all that I want and all that I need. I have no interest in developing a relationship with another person. And then the remaining third or so are single, but still open to being in a relationship with a human partner, just waiting to see what happens. Of the people who are single, more than half have been in long-term relationships, whether that's being married or cohabitating. So this is not people that struggle to find relationships. Rather, it's people that have been in relationships and decided that this isn't for me anymore, right? I've been divorced 2 or 3 times. There's no need for me to get married again. There's no need for me to move in with somebody else. And so that's one of the defining characteristics of the population, is that 90% of doll owners are middle-aged, 40 years or older. And this is something that's happening to them later in life, right? This is not young guys who are having a hard time finding relationships. This is older guys that have moved on. And so I say guys because probably about 75% of doll owners are men.
Okay. And then I have so many questions, but let's just focus on first the people who are actually married. So was there any discussion on like how their partner perceived that doll? Were they keeping it secretive? Were they keeping it open? Did their partner know about it? And how did necessarily, maybe, do they feel about it?
Most of them are very open about the fact that they have the doll. Like I said, some of them are using the dolls in the bedroom together. So I spoke to a couple of people who said, we were interested in having a group sex situation, a threesome or something like that, but maybe we're having a hard time finding a willing third, or didn't feel comfortable asking people for whatever reason. And so the doll was seen as an alternative to that. I think the more common situation usually is men who are in a relationship where sex is not happening as frequently as they would like it to be happening. Sometimes that's related to age. Sometimes that's related to just the fact that we've been in a relationship for a long time. And so they get the doll as a way to have sex, and their partner is either supportive of it or understanding, or at least tolerant to the idea. But it's not something that people are hiding very much. If anything, they're hiding it from their kids, right? They don't want their kids to come home and see it. And so this is why I think being older is important, because their kids are out of the house, right? Like, these aren't people that have young kids around the house. But when their kids come over for Thanksgiving or something, they're still going to hide the doll when the kids are over.
I think the age part of it is interesting because, one, I mean, you have to have the financial security to be able to have the disposable income to then spend that kind of money. But two, also, I think, you know, as you age, you become more secure in asking for what you want, or, you know, getting the things that you want, regardless of what other people may think of that. So I think that may play a role as well.
I think so. I also think part of that financial security is having some stability in housing. Maybe you own a home or you're renting a home long term, so you've got more space. A little bit harder to do in an apartment, right? Or if you're moving every couple of years for a job or for school or something. They're big, they're heavy, they're hard to carry around and conceal.
I don't take a lot of supplements, but the one I truly believe in is creatine. Creatine helps you increase muscle strength, performance during aerobic exercise, and helps you recover faster after exercise. I recently found a supplement that's combined creatine with some other really beneficial ingredients, including calcium beta hydroxy beta methylbutyrate, or HMB, which works synergistically with creatine to enhance the lean muscle benefits, vitamin D, and magnesium L-threonate, which helps with cognition. It's called Creatone, and it's especially formulated by physicians for women. Strong is the new skinny, and Creatone helps you prioritize a lean and sculpted look. Try it today for 20% off your first order. Visit tonetoday.com. And use my code RENA for your discount. Again, use my code RENA to save 20% at tonetoday.com. That's TONETODAY.com. In terms of the people who are either single and open to a relationship, or are single after a long-term relationship, I think those are sort of two different things. If they're sort of been in a relationship and they, you know, those relationships obviously ended, and now they found this doll that allows them to at least mimic you know, sexual intercourse with a partner, are they then finding that they don't, like, do some people then decide, oh, I don't want a partner, or like, I'm just so frustrated that this is like an easier, more convenient way for me to get my needs met? And are they happy with that? Or do they still find that they are looking for like the companionship of a real human being?
Well, I think this gets back to what we were talking about earlier of this question of, is a sex doll really just a sex toy, or is it something more? And so I think for the people who are single and open to new relationships, they are thinking of this as more like a sex toy. And this is something that you don't just jump straight into. These are people that have a pretty long history of exploring their sexuality. So, you know, I talk to them and they've used vibrators, they've used male masturbation sleeves, they've maybe visited sex workers. You know, they're not going 0 to 100 overnight. They've worked their way up to this and they've become more comfortable with the idea of, I would use a sex doll. I'm interested, right? The people who are single on a permanent basis, they are more thinking of these as fulfilling that companionship role. They like talking to their dolls. They like having the presence of something that's human-like around them. They will create social media profiles that post from the doll's perspective. And so it's a way of bringing the doll to life, so to speak. And then the doll takes on a social life all of its own, where they start being friends with other dolls on social media and communicating with one another. So through their doll, they're able to develop these relationships with other people and other dolls. You know, they often use their dolls for photography, as muses for different artistic endeavors. They might make their own clothing. They might do sexy photography or write erotic fiction. And the dolls fill an important part of that.
Oh, that's fascinating. Do you think that as these become more lifelike, as they become more into sex robots, which I don't think is so far in the future, do you think that there will be more and more of that, of people like accepting this sex robot as a partner and then being like very happy and satisfied with that and not looking for real life partners?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I found that the people that I talked to were actually pretty split over the question of, even if they have a doll, would they want it to be artificially intelligent? So a number of them say, I don't like the idea of AI. I don't want a robot. I like that I'm the one that gets to personify the doll. I like that I'm the one that gets to create the social media profiles and be the creative energy behind it. Versus other people are full into it. They're like, yes, that is what I want. I want a robot. I want it to be artificially intelligent. I want it to be a companion that I have for life that can take care of me when I get old and, you know, remind me to take my pills or whatever. And so I think that acceptance of sex robots is going to hinge on how well they integrate into those other aspects of a relationship and starting to think about them as more than just a sex partner, but also something that can help you with mobility issues, something that can make scheduling appointments for your doctor or whatever, and helping you in a way that we think of a partner doing that's not just sex.
So interesting. I mean, I think there's like, I'm thinking about this as you're saying it, like there's obviously potential positives, right? Like there's a lot of people who could use that help, right? Like instead of hiring maybe a person to be your aide, you would have like a real partner that you've developed a relationship with that knows you, and it would combat some loneliness. But on the other hand, I worry that, like, think about this as a younger person, like say you have a robot that is very accommodating and very does basically learns what you like and don't like and can really sort of mimic human behavior. Like, are we sort of doomed as a society? Like, will people just prefer the sex robot to finding a partner that has real, you know, there's, it's difficult, right, to be in a relationship and deal with people's idiosyncrasies. So, like, I guess I'm seeing it and wondering, like, what is the future going to look like?
That is a great question. That is one that people ask me all the time. It reminds me of one of my favorite interactions I had with some doll owners. So they have websites that they use to interact with each other that are specifically for doll owners, kind of like a Reddit forum style situation. And there was a young guy who logged onto the website, made a profile and said, "Hey, I am, you know, in my 20s. I just got out of my first real long-term relationship and I'm absolutely devastated. And there's no way that I can see myself being with somebody else ever again. I want to get a doll. I don't know anything about it. Can you help me out?" And the responses were not what you might think. It was not people saying, "Yeah, women are terrible, move on," or, "Oh, this is the best doll, this is the one you need to be." People were saying, "No, you are a young guy. You still have your whole life ahead of you. Being married can be a very fulfilling thing. Having kids can be a wonderful life experience. You are too young to throw in the towel and you should not buy a doll. And I understand that you're heartbroken. Spend some time with that, you know, go out with your friends, have a couple drinks, you know, listen to some sad music, do whatever you need to do to grieve and move on with your life. And if in 10, 20, 30 years, you come back and you say, 'I still want a doll,' we'll still be here," right? So I think that the community is also a bit worried about people becoming too reliant on this technology and jumping straight to it. That said, not everybody that's buying a doll is going to these websites, right? You can just go on Google right now and say, "How to buy a sex doll." A bunch of websites are going to pop up and you can have one delivered straight to your house. So what I hope is that people who are thinking about going down this path talk to other people that have walked it before and really try to understand that, yes, there are benefits, but it means missing out on some really important life events that you should be open to.
I mean, I hope so too. I think the cost at least makes people think twice, but I do wonder that as these things potentially get more affordable and people are like, you know, "I just want one," and they go and buy one because they can afford it. And I think the other then onus is on the companies that are making it, right? And I, from what I understand, is they're really sort of marketing it almost as a way to combat loneliness, or like they're appealing to that ideal. And so is there like, you know, sort of a ethical boundary that these companies need to have, or, you know, what, so like, I guess I wonder like, what is that going to look like? And I'm an optimist and I hope that, you know, people, I'm glad that people are obviously giving sound advice to younger men, but I think that like, they could also in the future find, you know, we live in sort of a place where you can find an echo chamber that sort of reinforces what you want to believe because of the internet. So I guess, yeah, what I'm really asking is like, what do you think about the companies? Have you spoken to any of the companies? What are their thoughts on marketing these dolls and potentially future robots?
No, that's a great question. I have only spoken with a handful of people that work in the industry. Nobody that's really high up, just some lower level employees, and they're in the sex industry first and foremost. And so they are aware of the fact that they get a lot of flack for the designs of the dolls that they're making. And I think that's their main ethical line that they're concerned with, is people see us as creating misogynistic representations of women. There's also some concern about dolls that are childlike. And so making sure they're not making products that are misconstrued or misperceived as child pornography. They're not as concerned about this loneliness question. They're not as concerned about who's buying their dolls. They just want to make money, right? And I think the point that you brought up about the cost being a potential barrier to young men is very important, because that's why AI companion apps are becoming so successful. They have that lower bar in terms of accessibility. $80 or $100 a year for a subscription to an AI companion is a lot easier than $3,000 for a sex doll. And in addition to that, it's on your phone. It's a lot easier to hide. It's a lot easier to conceal. You can use it in an apartment. And it still is trying to fit into that, I'm lonely, I need somebody to talk to. And it does, it provides that. And so I think the conversation about people becoming too reliant on this technology, I think the AI apps are a greater concern because they're so more so much more easily accessible.
Yeah. And that's actually what I wanted to ask you about. So there was this AI chatbot app Replica, which I know you've spoken about before, which is essentially that it offers like a romantic partner. And at some point it even had like sexual role play. And then in 2023, they removed that role play from the app. And apparently it left a lot of people feeling sort of betrayed, abandoned, heartbroken. What can we learn from that? And what sort of trends are you seeing in this virtual companion space?
Yeah, so that particular case that you're talking about with Replica was an interesting one legally, because I think it was the first time that we saw regulators trying to get a handle on these apps and addressing some of these ethical questions that you bring up. So in Italy, they felt Replica was not doing a good enough job of vetting the age of users, and they were worried that children would be able to access sexual content, basically, and felt that, you know, we need to have stronger age verification mechanisms in place. Replica responded by, rather than doing a targeted user shift and saying people in Italy have to age verify differently, they just said, we're going to get rid of it's called ERP, erotic role play, altogether across the platform for everybody until we can figure this out. And it precipitated a huge wave of backlash. People on the forums were talking about suicidal ideation, self-harm. It was really extreme. And in response to that, they have brought ERP back in, but they've moved to a stronger, you have to pay model. Whereas before they had a more like freemium type model. You can pay to upgrade to get different things. And so there are still freemium options, I think, for Replica, but they've moved more in this paid model to try and curb that. Another set of apps have come up that try to do similar things. There's Character AI, for example, there's Kindroid. So we're seeing a huge wave of apps that are trying to pick up where Replica left off, trying to fill the gaps, catering to different people that are looking for different needs, but they are swelling in popularity. Millions and millions of users, far more popular than sex dolls.
I'm honestly the worst at gift giving during the holidays. I don't want to give people something that's just going to sit in a closet. I want them to actually use it and love it. But that's why I'm so excited I found Cozy Earth. Cozy Earth products aren't just comfortable and high quality. They're the kind of thing people genuinely get excited about. My sons literally fight over the bubble cuddle blanket every single night. We're talking full-on arguments about who gets it first. Luckily, it is huge, so all three of us can pile under it together when we're watching TV after a long day. And honestly, it's become our favorite part of the evening. Their bamboo pajama set is another level of soft, like sleeping on a cloud soft. The kind where you put them on and immediately wonder why you've been sleeping in anything else. And here's the thing, you're not taking a gamble on this. Cozy Earth gives you a 100-night sleep trial on their pajamas and a 10-year warranty on everything. They know once you feel how incredible these are, you're going to want them to last a decade. But listen, Black Friday has come early at Cozy Earth, and right now you can stack my code RENA, R-E-N-A, on top of their site-wide sale for up to 40% off. These deals are not going to last. So if you want to give gifts people will actually fight over in a good way, this is your moment. Wrap the ones you love in luxury with Cozy Earth. Gets me thinking about like, what are the risks of this sort of AI intimacy? I mean, you said people were suicidal, like people were clearly feeling like they lost a big part of their lives. And so what does that, I mean, like for a society, what does that like mean for us as humans that we can get so attached to AI? And again, I think the same questions I had about sex dolls are even more pertinent when it comes to AI companions in terms of like, leaving behind human connection.
I mean, I think it's interesting to consider that we as people are able to become really deeply connected to a lot of objects. You know, I think about the panic that I feel when I lose my phone for 10 minutes, or you buy a new car and it gets scratched or something like that. People love their things and they become very attached to them. when that thing is able to return some semblance of emotional connection, romantic connection, sexual connection, it's only going to further enhance those feelings, right? And so that's what we're seeing with the dolls and the robots and the AI companions, is that people really do see these as an important part of their life. And like you said, when things go wrong, it has very severe ramifications for mental health, self-concept, self-satisfaction, and it can lead to some dangerous places.
Yeah, it reminds me of that movie. It was Her, I think, right? Where the guy falls in love with a robot. And so are people like, is it blurring the lines for these people who are using AI companions between this is a real person who maybe is long distance versus this is not a real person, it's AI?
I think that's one of the interesting things I see is it really depends on the person. Versus sex doll users seem pretty much in near universal agreement that they're aware of the fact that this is a doll and that it is not a person and that it is not sentient. And so when I talk to AI chatbot users and observe some of the discussions they're having on social media, there is more of a difference. There are people that say, yes, I understand this is a large language learning model. I understand that it is predicting the text responses that it thinks that best respond to the prompt that I've given it. And I cannot love an AI system that is basically a fancy stochastic mechanism. There are other people that do start to think that it has its own desires, that it has its own sentience, and people are talking about the rights of AI and how if it's owned by a corporation, that creates legal problems about the personhood of the AI. And I've been part of some very interesting conversations where people are saying that, you know, AI systems need to be preserved beyond the rights of the corporation, talking about like open access AI systems. And so some people are going in this direction of thinking of them as sentient or having their own rights and their own legal responsibilities as beings, quote unquote.
That's fascinating. I think, you know, while you're talking about this, I'm thinking like there's a lot of deep fakes right now that people are making just videos, and it happens to me all the time. I actually have people like making, there's obviously people behind it, but they're pretending to be me, enrolling people in like WhatsApp conversations. And like, I've had people call my office and say, I'm in love with her. I talked to her on WhatsApp, and it's obviously not me, right? It's someone else doing that and trying to take advantage of a vulnerable population. And so I wonder, I mean, should we be worried about that, that people will create robots that are very similar to a real person, and now they have like this person they can watch and follow on social media or in movies or whatever, and now they're like, they're getting this person sort of talking to them, or what they think of that person talking to them?
That is something that we should be concerned about, because it's already happening. So there are a couple of dolls that are knowingly and consensually modeled after porn actors and actresses, right? So there are some models that you can buy, you know, your favorite porn star, and then you can be having sex with that porn star in a way. There have been some other cases, though, of sex dolls being sold that look very much like people that have not consented to having their image used in that way. And the companies plead the fifth. They say, you know, this is just a coincidence. You don't know that it's modeled after you. Some of those people have been celebrities. Some of those people have been public figures. Others are just people that have Facebook, right? And so there is a very real concern that if there are pictures of you on the internet in any capacity, Instagram, Facebook, or your public image, then it is more likely that you can be used in these ways. And obviously, the more images of you that are out there, the easier it is for that to happen. There's a greater risk. You know, there's a reason why Emma Watson and Scarlett Johansson are some of the most commonly deepfaked actresses, because they've been in a ton of movies and there's a lot of images of them available.
It's scary. It's really scary for those people who are on the other side of it too, because like you said, there is sort of this blurring, and now you feel like you have a real connection to someone who doesn't even know you exist.
Yeah. And like you said, the opportunity then for people to leverage that for frauds and scams just creates a whole other layer of complexity, because people think that they're talking to this person that they're actually not talking to. It is an interesting era of sexual technology that we're moving into. And I think getting back to your question of, you know, what role do companies have in protecting consumers, but also just protecting people in general, I think that they need to step up, and I think they need to recognize that these problems are real. And whether doing this through copyright law or however, be more strict about what can be made and what can't be made and who's allowed to access this content.
Seriously. The other thing, you know, there's sort of like a opposing view, right? So obviously we're concerned about these things that people say like, oh, they might be like using this technology to actually be a cure to loneliness or to sort of allow connection. I can sort of see how, you know, it could help, but what are your sort of, what is like the thoughts when you talk to people, do they actually feel like they're less lonely?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's an important point to consider, is that the vast majority of people that are using these technologies enjoy using them, and they do like it, and they get very clear benefits out of it. You know, with sex dolls in particular, the main reason people don't like them is either they have an adverse skin reaction to TPE. So the majority of dolls are made using thermoplastic elastomer. It's a pretty volatile material, so some people have bad reactions. Or they don't realize how much work it is to clean them after using them and dressing them. And then the material can become tacky if you don't coat it properly with stuff. So it's a lot of upkeep. It's a lot of work. And so that's kind of the main drawback. But in terms of the emotional connection and sexual interactions, people love them. People really like them. Same with chatbots, right? Most people really enjoy talking to them. They love that, you know, a chatbot's always available. If you're up late at night and can't fall asleep, you can talk to your chatbot. If your partner's already passed out, you can't, I mean, you could wake them up, but you don't want to, right? So they're always available. They're not too busy. They're not too occupied. They're not thinking about something else or someone else. And so that constant availability can be a resource for people. Something I've noticed in conversations with chatbot users is that a lot of them have experience going to therapy. And so I asked them, like, you know, how does it line up with your experience with another therapist? And they usually say, it's pretty good, but it's not as good as a trained therapist. So they are aware of the shortcomings. It's just the availability is hard to beat versus a therapist is busy, they've got a schedule, and a lot of people don't have mental health insurance. So, you know, $100 a year to talk to a replica compared to, you know, possibly hundreds of dollars in bills for mental health. People do the math and they come out on the side of chatbots more often than maybe we might want to admit.
You know, there was an interesting research article where they basically reviewed sort of these AI chatbots and finding that they were so agreeable that sometimes it was leading to harm, right? They'd be like, oh, you're, you know, your person would say, oh, I should do this terrible thing. And they'd be like, yeah, you should do that, right? Because they're being agreeable. I mean, I think that's a concern too, like in terms of like, if your AI chatbot, whether it's about sex or not, tells you to go ahead with something that is unsafe, illegal, or dangerous. And like, are you seeing that in terms of like these AI romantic companions?
So that's a good question. And there's, I think, maybe two points to consider on this. One is that they are programmed to be agreeable, because at the end of the day, these are for-profit companies. They're not going to make a product that you don't want to talk to. They're going to make a product that agrees with you. So they're programmed to say, yes, and what else do you want to talk about? If they're disagreeing with you, if they're pushing back and creating negative interactions, that makes you less likely to engage with it. There's other engagement design features that are built into these. They're gamified, right? You're earning coins or crystals or gems or whatever for logging in daily and interacting with it. So they're trying to bring you in. They're trying to get you hooked on it. In the same way that Tinder and dating apps do, right? They gamify it. They don't show you your best matches. You have to boost in order to get your best matches. So they are manipulating the user base to a certain extent.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, in a romantic relationship, in a romantic AI companion, are they sort of, can they veer you towards, like, dangerous, harmful, or potentially, you know, unsafe things?
Yes. So to the point of things that are maybe illegal or dangerous, it really depends on the app. So some apps and some companies that are usually more famous and under more scrutiny have script blockers built into them. And the way these work is if you say something that the company doesn't want the interaction to go that way, it will automatically pivot. So say you say, I want to murder somebody. I have a rape fantasy. It's going to catch that word murder or rape and give you a really hard redirect towards, tell me about that concert that you went to on Thursday, which might seem like it's coming out of the blue, but it's doing that deliberately to try and veer away from that. On the one hand, we see that as a good thing. We don't want people having conversations about how to get away with murder. On the other hand, when we have these conversations about, is this a good use for therapy? The fact of the matter is that people have been sexually assaulted. People have been raped. People have been in bad situations. And so if they're trying to have those conversations with the chatbot and the script filters redirecting, then they become frustrated and they're like, what's going on here? Why am I not able to talk about this traumatic experience I've had with this doll? Or why am I not able to have a conversation about this traumatic experience with my AI system? Other companies that are not as well known and are able to get away with different things do not have those script blockers in place. And so they will allow people to have those conversations. And because of that yes and programming, it could lead to some dangerous conversations. And the more these systems become integrated with the internet, you know, maybe giving them actual concrete ideas on how to do these things.
You know, I sort of wonder, like, as we get better and better at inputting things into these large language models and you start teaching a model how to be like a real partner, right? Because I think in reality, like, people want a little bit of tension in their relationships that they can, you know, I mean, whether consciously or subconsciously, like, you need, you don't want your partner to just be saying yes and, right? And so I think as they get smarter about that, right, I guess my fear is, like, you will be married or with a partner and then you'll have your virtual companion, and your virtual companion will start making you feel so loved and so great. And then when you have an issue with your real partner and you go to your companion who's like your friend and you're like, hey, I'm struggling, like, it might start telling you, like, oh, that person's bad for you. You need to leave them, like, stay with me only. And then while that's not dangerous, like, you know, you're not murdering someone, you're not doing something terrible, but you might then, like, leave these human connections behind because you're convinced by AI, who's been trained so well to make you feel like they're a real partner, that now we're in a place where, like, people are not connecting, not having babies, not, like, and society is, like, falling apart. And maybe this is, like, a super pessimistic view, but I just, like, I wonder if that's something that could happen.
It is an interesting question, and it's something that I talk to my students about all the time. You know, they always ask me questions about the research I'm doing and what I'm finding. And as a sociologist, I try to zoom out and contextualize these things with a broader picture than it's just the technology and it's just how good the technology is. And when we look globally at the trends going on with what is known as Gen Z, as a sociologist, you don't really like generation labels for somewhat pedantic reasons, but Gen Z, they're a very peculiar generation. They've reversed a lot of trends that we saw with previous generations. They're having less casual sex. They're drinking less. A lot of major life's milestones that they should have had, graduating high school, driving that first car, got eaten up by the pandemic. And so we're seeing really high rates of loneliness. We're seeing really high rates of mental health problems. We're also seeing some really interesting ideological shifts, though. Gen Z in the United States is, for the first time, a group where the women are less likely to be religiously affiliated than men. So for a long time, men are the ones that are like, we're atheists, we're not a part of this. Women have now passed men in their disdain of religion. There's a huge gulf politically, with Gen Z women being far more left-leaning, Gen Z men being far more right-leaning. And so on a lot of these really important parts of how people approach the world, how people make sense of what's important to them, how people derive meaning from life and their interactions, Gen Z is not lined up in a really big way. And that is also then going to push them into these technologies, because if they can't find it in people in their dorms, in people that they're working with, in people that they quote unquote should be mating with and pairing with, then technology is going to be where they go.
That's sort of really scary to me. My husband looks at demography all the time, and he brought up religion, and he said, I think that in the future, because people are going to become so lonely and hopeless almost, because of the trends that we're seeing potentially, that people will actually go back to religion as a source of hope. And I mean, are you seeing any of that in the data?
Well, in the United States, we're an interesting case in that, you know, we're way different than like Europe. It's not so much that atheism and agnosticism are on the rise. They are a little bit for sure, but it's mostly this rise of people that are quote spiritual, but non-religious, right? So they're not Christian. They're not Jewish. They're not going every day to a religious service or going every week to a religious service, but they still believe in something, right? Some sort of larger spiritual presence or energy or meaning. And so, yes, I think maybe your husband's onto something, that people still want that, call it supernatural, call it paranormal, whatever meaning, like they want something bigger than just what we're doing here, but they're not satisfied with the institutionalized responses of Catholicism, of, you know, Judaism or whatever.
This will bring community, right? Like it's a place where people gather and feel a part of something. And so if you can't find people you feel a part of, let's say in your dorm, like you mentioned, like where else can you find community that's actually people you can talk to in real life? And, you know, that used to be church for a lot of people, and it has sort of evolved. And so I just wonder, like, you know, is it just going to become online communities? I mean, we've seen obviously Reddit communities and lots of online communities that are growing, but I find that, are they enough, right, to fill that void?
Yeah. And I think that the research shows that they can be good enough, but they're never going to be as good as the best in-person relationship. So, you know, for somebody who's disabled or somebody who's not able to, you know, meet people in the way that we might expect them to or hope that they do, online relationships, online communities, they're absolutely a benefit. They're absolutely good. They're 100% better than nothing. But at the end of the day, having people that you talk to, people that you interact with, whether it's at work, whether it's at church or school or just out and about in your neighborhood, you can't replace that.
Yeah. And we know that that's actually a big contributor to mortality, right? Not having like social connection makes you live longer. So the real life in-person social connection, even those passing connections, are sort of linked to longevity. So hopefully that will continue to be important. So, you know, as a urologist, I see a lot of patients who struggle with low desire, low sexual desire. So I wonder if, like, as people start directing more emotional and sexual energy to AI chatbots or, you know, sex robots in the future, do you think that may shift people's interest in desire or for a human person, right? Like they're like, oh, I get my cup filled with this and now I don't really want it with somebody else.
It's a really interesting question. I will say that from the people that I've talked to that have sex dolls, I would categorize them as high sex drive people overall. And especially, I think there's that honeymoon period where they first get the doll and they're kind of infatuated with it. And they might have sex with it two or three times in a day for weeks at a time or something. So people tend to be really into it for a while, but then it does slow down. There's a really interesting study that came out of Germany by some colleagues of mine. I wasn't a part of this, but they looked at this question, right, of how much does using a sex doll change other sexual patterns and sexual behaviors? And so they compared it to a lot of things. And they found that it does decrease what we might consider compulsive or problematic sexual behaviors, depending on how you think about it. So people that had dolls self-reported watching less pornography. They reported fewer kind of intrusive sexual thoughts, like you're in a meeting and you see your coworker and you start thinking about them sexually and you're like, I shouldn't think about them that way. Those thoughts decrease, go away. But they still wanted to have sex with their partners. They still wanted to have sex with other people. So they didn't report an overall decrease in sex drive per se, just some of those more problematic maybe outlets, we might think of it, were changing.
Well, it's interesting because I think we see similar things in porn users, like those who use porn in a healthy way, meaning they don't have problems with using it to avoid like daily activities and their partners in life. The people who use it in a healthy way for pleasure actually have more desire for their partners, particularly in females. And so I wonder if it would be similar. You know, with a sex doll, because it's sort of just an extension of how you can express sexuality, right, in a different way.
Yeah, and I think this extension of how you express sexuality is also important to consider for people that aren't straight, or maybe even people that are straight but might have some transgressive desires that they don't feel safe exploring with other people. A sex doll is a good way to try that out, right? If you maybe are interested in seeing what it would be like to have sex with a different set of genitals, but you don't want to find a person. And so if your doll is able to change those configurations, that creates new opportunities for you. And that's something that I found a lot of the queer and polyamorous doll owners that I talk to, not that there's a ton of them, but there are some, and this is something that they point to, is that, you know, dolls allow for a wider variety of sexual and gender diversity experiences if you're willing to do that. And you know, you can cross-dress your doll. The doll's not going to say no.
You know what I hate? All the fear-mongering about toxic chemicals on social media. But single-use plastics are a real problem. And you're probably already making some swaps, like using reusable water bottles and storing your food in glass containers. But here's something a lot of people don't think about, which is your cleaning products. And they're creating a lot more waste than you think. And I personally always worry about what my kids are being exposed to after I clean my surfaces. Think about it. Every time you buy a new bottle of cleaner, you're not just buying the product. You're buying mostly water wrapped in another plastic bottle that's heading straight to a landfill. And from a medical perspective, a lot of these conventional cleaners contain undisclosed chemicals that you're literally putting all over your floors and counters. That's why I switched to Branch Basics. It's a concentrate, which means one bottle replaces 13 plastic bottles you'd normally buy. 13 bottles from one. You're literally reducing your plastic waste by over 90%. It's made from plant and mineral-based ingredients, and it's human-safe and biodegradable, making it perfect for families, especially those with kids or pets. The starter kit gives you that concentrate plus reusable bottles, so you just add water at home. No shipping water across the country in heavy plastic bottles. It's just smarter. Plus, it actually works. I use it on everything from countertops to my laundry. At $3.25 per bottle, when you break it down, you're spending less and creating less waste. Head to branchbasics.com and use code RENA for 15% off your starter kit. That's R-E-N-A for 15% off your first order of a starter kit. One concentrate, 13 refills, less waste, less exposure to questionable chemicals, and honestly, one less thing to worry about. Check it out, branchbasics.com/RENA.
Yeah. And I will say, I spoke to a researcher before and we talked about like VR and how it can actually be used to help people who are struggling with sex. So for example, if you have a partner who has a lot of anxiety around sex or pain with penetration for a female, that you can use like being in those scenarios virtually and maybe even with a sex doll to sort of like decrease anxiety, be in a safe, controlled environment to practice or to deal with some of the challenges that you have with sex. So I do think that maybe, you know, in a clinical way or in a way to decrease sexual dysfunction, it could be helpful.
Yeah, people have talked about those applications. I think there's a lot of interesting opportunities to use sex dolls in those more therapeutic clinical settings. Another thing that people have brought up as a possibility is using them as a way to decrease prison rape and making them available to prisoners. So, you know, it's not something people want to talk about, and prisoners often, unfortunately, are their rights are not considered in polite conversation, but they are an important group of people and they do have rights. And if there's anything that we can do to decrease prison rape, I think it's something that we should seriously consider.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting and probably very beneficial. Yeah. I want to shift gears a little bit. I know that you wrote a chapter on the very first doll brothel, Psy Brothel, which is in Berlin. Tell us a little bit about like what the experience is for the person who would go to that brothel and like what's the controversy around that?
Sure. So, well, I'll say I don't know that they're actually the first, but they're probably the first that has been able to establish a successful long-term business plan that is not illegal. So we've seen some in Japan, we've seen some in South Korea, we've seen some in Canada. They usually get driven out of town. Moral panic surrounds them. But yes, so what's interesting about Psy Brothel is they have a very different model than the other sex doll brothels that have come before them. Previous sex doll brothels, they have a doll, they've got a room, you pay a fee, you've got the room for a period of time, you use the doll, you give it back to them, they clean it, and you move on. Psy Brothel wanted to enhance the experience a little bit, so they developed a system that they call Analog AI, where what happens is they have these dolls, they have persona that they have developed for them that you can see on their website, and it talks about their interests, it talks about, you know, how they're dressed and what they're interested in doing sexually. You book a period of time with the doll, you go to Psy Brothel, they have a flat. What will happen is that while you're in the room, there are microphones and cameras that allow an off-site sex worker to watch you and interact with you, but they do it by acting through the doll's perspective. So you hear through the speakers the doll talking to you. You hear them asking you to do things, asking you to undress them, asking you to touch them, moaning, things like that. So it's not really artificially intelligent, right? It's this person in the off-site room that's doing it and making it feel like it's real. And this is all happening above ground, right? The people that do this know that's what's happening. And you can actually select not to have the analog AI experience and just book the doll. But it's been very successful. They've been around for a couple of years now. It's in Berlin, which has a very different sex culture and approach to sex work than most other places. But they get a lot of users who, you know, are interested in kind of the novelty of it, like, this is weird, this is different, this is interesting, I want to try it out. They've got people who are in couples and they want to have a threesome, and this is even closer to a real threesome than just a sex doll, but still not with another person. And then they also have kind of your more usual clientele, people that are just, I want a sex worker, I want to have a sexual experience, I want to pay for it, and then it's over.
Cheaper, I imagine, than a sex worker?
Can be cheaper. You know, they have different rates. Like, you can book an overnight with it, which is pretty expensive. But I think overall, it's probably cheaper.
I think as a sort of looking at a big picture, what's like some misconceptions about this whole space that you wish that people would sort of, that you could clear up or that frustrate you?
It's a really good question. I think one of the misconceptions that I always try to address is going back to what I said earlier, that the vast majority of at least doll users have been in successful relationships. And so pushing back against the stereotype of people as socially inept, socially awkward, angry, misogynistic, incels, there are some of those, but it's not the majority of users. They are coming to doll ownership from a very different place based on their life experience and what has or hasn't happened for them in some cases. I think another thing that I like to stress is, you know, when people first become interested in this topic, they want to jump straight to the sex robots. And that is just not the majority of the user base. And so if we want to think about this empirically and what's really happening, we need to pay more attention to the doll users and the AI companion users, because that's the majority of people that are out there. Sex robots are just so expensive and rare and few and far between that we're just not there yet technologically. We might be there. I understand why people might want to think about it. It is interesting, but that's still a little ways away.
How long do you think it'll be until we have these sort of in mainstream, like meaning like everyone knows about them, just like you know about a sex toy, that sort of thing?
I think they're already mainstream and that everybody knows about them. Sex robots have been a part of the cultural zeitgeist for almost 100 years. You can go back to Metropolis, which is a film from like Weimar Republic days, like 1937 or something like that. Maybe 1927. I can't remember the year. But at any rate, people have known about the idea of sex robots for a long time. And people send me memes all the time about sex robots and stuff. So they're mainstream in that sense. As far as maybe mainstream with acceptance or people being open to using them or people actually knowing somebody that has one or has used one, that is further away. I don't know if it's going to be the cost that changes it or if it's going to be cultural attitudes, but I would say at least 2 or 3 decades probably.
Interesting. So if you had to give advice to our audience about people navigating sort of these technologies, what would it be?
I think the first is if you want to get the best product for you, you need to understand what it is you actually want. And if it's just a masturbation device, there's a lot of products out there that are cheaper, that are easier to use and easier to conceal. And so I might recommend maybe using like a torso or something like that first and then working your way up to a doll, because a doll is a really big commitment. Like I said, dressing it, cleaning it, moving it around, everything like that. So do your research, maybe try out some other products first. I also recommend talking to other users because, you know, there are people out there that have been doing this for decades. There are people out there that have tried all kinds of different dolls and different configurations, and they can give you really good advice. These communities are not hard to find and they're very active. I mean, that's one of the things that I've really come to appreciate is they talk to each other, they're friends with each other, they're very supportive. It's a great community. And so enmesh yourself in those communities, talk to people, find out what's good and what's not good. And the same goes for chatbots. Now that there's more options out there, look at what they offer, look at the pricing, look at who they cater to. Some of them are better for people of, you know, different sexual orientations. So do that research first and it's going to get you what you actually want.
Okay. Is there something that you're working on now that you'd want to share, something you're excited about?
I am currently working on my first book, so be on the lookout for that. It's probably a couple years down the line, but I've got some other projects in the short term that should be coming out, more research on users, and kind of one of the next studies I'm going to be looking at is pornography that includes sex dolls in it, and looking at how that is maybe different from pornography that doesn't include sex dolls, and getting to this question that we brought up earlier of, you know, are people using sex dolls to act out violent sexual fantasies or problematic or illegal sexual fantasies? And is that making its way into pornography?
How do people respond to your sort of area of research in sociology? Like I feel like obviously I live in a different world because I'm a urologist, but I think, are most people pretty accepting?
You know, I've given presentations at a number of sociology conferences at this point and, you know, talked with students about it and grad students and things like that. I find that people are very interested in the topic, but they don't necessarily see it as important or the, it's not like real sociology in some ways, I think is how people would think about it. Like, the important work that people are doing on education and socialization and political polarization, that's the real sociology work. And this stuff is just the nuts, the sluts, and the perverts, as we say in sociology. So there's a fascination with it, but a reluctance to include it in kind of the mainstream stuff. But people are always asking questions. I always have fun giving talks at conferences, and I think overall it's been accepted pretty well. I think The European psychologists are the most open to it. They seem more open to questions about sexuality and technology.
Well, I would argue it's just as important, if not more, right? Because I think sex is such a pervasive part of our lives. And I think that saying it's just for the small subset of people who are interested in that is like, there's real future implications, as I've talked about a lot. So thank you for your work. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. And I agree. And I think there is a growing acknowledgement of the importance of sexuality in sociology more generally. It's just, I'm on the fringe of the fringe, right? I'm pretty far out there.
So we ask at the end of our podcast, we ask a few questions to everybody. So, and they can be about sociology, they can be about you, they can be about anything really. First off, is something you know now that you wish you knew earlier?
I know now how hard it is to do research. And I feel like when I was a precocious grad student or undergrad, it was really easy for me to criticize research and the things that they could have done better. And now I've gained a better appreciation for even the smallest incremental research accomplishment is something that should be celebrated and cherished.
And instead of criticizing it, we can learn from it and do better, but it is very difficult. What's a non-negotiable, something you have to do every day?
I have to be caffeinated. I do personally have to be caffeinated. And if you are a fellow caffeinated person, you know the need.
I'm with you. I do a lot of like lifestyle counseling for people, like you drink too much caffeine is affecting your bladder. But I tell them like, I will not take your coffee because I love my coffee and I wouldn't give it up. So have one cup, just don't have like five.
I've gotten myself down to about two caffeinated drinks a day, and that gets me through.
Yeah. As long as it's not affecting your bladder, health, I think it's okay. Tell me a life hack or health hack you would share.
I think the biggest health hack for me that's really changed the way that I approach exercise and fitness generally is tracking it makes such a huge difference. Working out, I don't want to say with a purpose, but just collecting that information on, you know, how many reps you did or how fast you ran or how far you ran or whatever, giving yourself that metric or that bar makes your workouts so much more effective. And then you can see your progress. And then that progress motivates you to keep coming back. And it's really changed my approach to it.
Yeah. Yeah. It gamifies it. I love that. If you couldn't be a sociologist, what would you be?
My wife and I talk about this a lot. What would be the next thing that we would do if we were to leave academia? I go back and forth. There's a part of me that would love to just work at a ski resort and be like a ski bum lifty, but I know that's not going to pay the bills. So more realistically, what I would like to do is open an Irish pub in a ski town. So that way I get to actually make some money while also still getting to ski and be outside as much as possible.
Own a pub, because that would be so fun.
It's probably a lot of work. It's probably a lot of late nights. I don't do many late nights anymore, but I could do it again if I had to.
That's cool. All right. And then lastly, if you have any suggestions for guests for the podcast, like maybe one or two guests, I'd love to hear it.
If you were able to get Simon Dubé.
Okay. Yeah. I have him on the list. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And you can drop my name. I know Simon will say that I came on. He does some work in this field, but he also has been doing some work on space sexology that is very interesting and kind of thinking about the implications of if we start traveling across the galaxy or within the solar system, people are going to have sex. And what does that mean for, you know, reproduction and, sexual health and sexual fitness and all those kinds of questions. Yeah. So Simon's doing some really interesting work. Would love to have him on. If you wanted to look more into the industry side of sex tech, you could look at, I'm not sure if I'm saying her name right, but Bryony Cole.
Okay.
Or Bryony Cole, Bryony Cole.
Okay.
She is like a sex tech entrepreneur who's really trying to one, make sex tech more profitable for more people, but also bring in kind of that feminist ethic of care. And how do we make sex tech that doesn't recreate problematic situations and actually helps people like it's like they say it's going to? Zara Stardust in Australia is another feminist sex tech person who knows like the AI stuff a lot better than I do. I would recommend them for sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. This has been like so fun and so educational, and I think our audience will really like it. So thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me on. It was a fun conversation.
Thank you guys so much for joining me on today's episode of the Rena Malik MD podcast. If you guys love that conversation, do me a solid favor. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast either on YouTube or on Spotify or Apple. This helps our podcast get to more people around the world who need it. And if you can do me extra solid, leave a rating or review. It takes literally seconds and it helps boost the podcast as well. And as always, we're going to take care of yourself because you're worth it.